The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 5th of November, 2020. On the podcast today, Cahill Friel, Executive Chairman of Open Orphan, discusses their 2.5 million influenza challenge study contract with a US biotech company. Also on the podcast, Chris Bailey, founder of Financial Orbit, covers news from the following companies: Sainsbury's, AstraZeneca, and Auto Trader. And John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talks about Eurasia Mining, Rainbow Rare Earths, Solgold, and of course we talk about a bit of macro news as well. And at the end of the podcast, as always, I will be highlighting two lists for you. The all-important top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. To get on this list is very good as a company. It means lots of people are researching, investing in these companies. Check that list out at voxmarkets.co.uk. And of course, whenever someone hits a follow button on a company, then that person will get RNSs straight to the front screen of their smartphone via notification whenever a company releases. So it's a direct line of contact from the company to the investor. All right, I also highlight the top five most liked RNSs out today. And of course, by the way, you can check out these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, and you'll see a lot of other content there, including our COVID-19 index. Biggest rise of the day on that index is Cromec Group, up 12.5% to 12.5. Wow, up 12.5. And the biggest fall of today is N4 Pharma, down 6% to 6.3 pence. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Cahill Friel, Executive Chairman of Open Orphan, ORPH's ticker. Cahill, thanks for joining me.
Justin, good to talk to you. Thanks for taking the call.
It seems like you're releasing a new contract pretty much every week. You've got a new contract now, a flu or influenza contract worth 2.5 million. That's impressive. So first of all, Cahill, you're on the podcast regularly, so no need to introduce the company, but tell us a bit more about this if you could.
Yeah, look, Justin, it took a bit of time to fix HVIVO Open Orphan, but as we say, it's fixed and it's really going. The contract is really exciting because we're really reassuring the market. We're not a one-trick pony. We're not purely a COVID story, and we're not purely an RSV challenge study. This is an influenza challenge study for 2.5 million sterling. It kicks off very soon, and it'll be done in the early part of next year. So this is really exciting for two reasons, in that we haven't done an influenza study in recent years. So it's the first one, and it just goes to prove there's a ton of work developing vaccines because of the pandemic. We're entering an era, I think, in the next 10 years, where HVIVO Open Orphan will be very busy testing more and more vaccines, and emphasize not solely, like we recently said, we're doing COVID-19 challenge studies, but this is not an influenza challenge study, which is great.
Yeah, but I suppose even with COVID, though, like you're saying, you know, the first vaccine won't be the be-all, end-all. There'll be continuous updatings, iterations, and different versions of the virus. So new vaccines are going to be needed every year, aren't they?
Yeah, look, the reality is, and like the world should relax, there's going to be a wave of COVID vaccines. We're working on a good number of them. Yeah. There'll be one every month, but like our contracts, there'll be new vaccines every month during the summer. So when we get to next summer, countries got to get through the bumpy winter, open, close. Come next summer, there'll be a dozen or more vaccines. None of them will work for more than a year. We don't think so. But that's fine. So the first wave of them, the first generation, will give you immunity for a year or protection for a year, and they'll probably remove the worst symptoms. Mm-hmm. There'll be loads more vaccines coming down the track in years to come for COVID. Some of them will last for 2 or 3 years. Some will remove all symptoms. So yeah, it's going to be a lot of work on COVID. So the country just got to get through this tricky month or two, and there's light at the end of the tunnel, and life will return. The way we'll look at it, take your annual flu jab, and by the way, when you're out, take your annual COVID jab. So COVID will be a long-distant bad memory late next year. But it does mean governments, countries around the world, pharma companies will spend billions building up pipelines and vaccines, so we never face this nonsense and chaos ever in our life again.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got, you know, like I say, flu, and you've got coronavirus here, and you know, there's a two, you know, viruses that affect millions of people that will need millions and billions of vaccines out there, and updating and iterating all the time. So the market, your market just got bigger, massively bigger. So I see that the Venn is providing the biometry services, this contract. So both sides of the company are now working on delivering this contract, are they?
Absolutely. Look, Justin, it's very important. We've put two companies together, but they now fit like a glove. HVivo is a world leader in the testing of vaccines, and hopefully you'll see us announcing some antiviral contracts soon. We haven't announced one of those in a while, but they're coming down the track. But then there's biometry. That's a data management biostats. Traditionally, they had to go and hunt for that work. Now, traditionally, HVivo had to get third-party contractors. They now provide those services directly into HVivo, so the two arms fit like a glove. So, yeah, really excited to have our Venn Paris teams working closely with us here. I'm based in London nearly full-time now at the moment, running the business. And, yeah, two arms are working rather nicely together.
Yeah, well, I see the only problem you seem to have, Kyle, is space. And where is this going to take place? Because I know you're pretty much booked out for a long period now.
Yeah, look, HVivo's problem in the past, it was never booked out for more than 2 or 3 months in advance. And look, being honest with you, we've been lucky. The pandemic has exploded the vaccine trial testing market, but we've been good at closing contracts. And yeah, this now has us more or less booked out until Christmas next year. Our target has always been booked out 2 years in advance, so we're getting close to that. And then our COVID-19 work has been done in the Royal Free Hospital. So on the back of that deal, we've kind of almost doubled our capacity. And yeah, we're always talking about maybe having access to a third facility somewhere. So let's cross that bridge when we come to it, which might come much sooner.
Yeah, I know you can't say, you know, too much about this US company, otherwise you would have said it in the RNS. But can you say anything about, are they one of the companies involved in Operation Warp Speed in the US?
Well, look, yeah, we can't really say too much. A lot of these vaccine biopharma companies are very sensitive. But yeah, look, you can take it as read. It's very likely it's part of that program. It's an influenza study. It's come out of left field very fast. So yeah, it's very likely to be one of those companies that our friend Mr. Trump is throwing tens of billions at as part of Operation Warp Speed. But we can't confirm, or we wouldn't deny it either. And we'd probably best to leave it for the moment like that. No doubt when we go into clinicaltrials.org. As soon as the protocol is filed, you'll see who it is.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And as always, Kyle, if someone's, you know, listened to this and think they may have missed a story here or missed out, give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add Open Orphan to their watch list, please.
Yeah, I think, look, Justin, we've said we've a rapidly grown company. We're doing that. We're very transparent. My wages are on all executives. There's no share options, no warrants, no nothing, no health clubs. So go to Open Orphan Investors and Corporate Governance. So we're very transparent. And third, we say we do a lot. We're doing a lot. And for anybody who really wants to be part of this decade of the explosion in vaccine work with limited downside, we're not doing any R&D. I think Open Orphan is a good place. We've guided the market. We want to raise our share price 50% every 6 months. That's been our plan. And our plan going forward will be try and keep nudging the share price up 50% every 6 months. So I think that's a good mantra for us to stick to and a target for everybody to work towards.
Excellent stuff. Kyle, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Justin, thank you very much. It's a pleasure as always.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
If I can do it, I'm going to introduce Chris Burley, founder of financialorbit.com. I'm sneezing nonstop. Chris, how's things?
Yeah, very well. Must be that gunpowder up your nose or something, as it's Guy Fawkes Day.
Yeah, something. I'm sneezing like it's a big banger. It's two bangers at my nose. It's unbelievable. Blow my head off nearly. But yes, excellent stuff. So, you were just talking that you stayed up for a long period to watch the US elections, did you?
Oh, absolutely. Somebody had to, and I find it fascinating, to be honest. Look, it's obviously, as we speak, it's still technically undecided, but I think we can see the way it's going to probably play out, which is Biden wins and Trump complains about it. But yeah, it was interesting because, as always with elections, you know, elections and markets, they're sort of interlinked, but they're not always correlated in quite the way you think. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, we've seen a bit of volatility during during October. You know, October was not a good month for markets generally, particularly in Europe and America. But November's got off to a stronger start. And, you know, this week we've had pre-election, pre-US election, we had a good day for value stocks. You know, big rotation in the markets, financials and industrials outperforming. And then the following day, you know, the last 24 hours, we've seen tech stocks outperform. So you could easily come to the conclusion that irrespective of what happens in the election, stocks only go up, which I guess would link with the fact that central banks around the world are still giving us lots of putting more free money into the economy. Bank of England announced this morning expansion of its money printing operations, its QE operations, and the Federal Reserve later on today will meet. I don't think they'll do anything, but no doubt they'll say, whatever it takes, we're there, boys. We're going to help stimulate the economy because, of course, it's still tough out there. Pandemic still lingers, still record cases in the States and I guess here as well. And, of course, we've got lockdown 2 kicking off today as well, ruining everybody's fireworks party.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? I'm just looking at a tweet that's on November the 3rd. It said, my US electionist prediction has only two outcomes. One, Trump wins easily. Two, Trump loses but will claim early victory, then challenge the results. Equal market volatility. Market volatility didn't happen, but the second point is, I can't see him getting out how are you going to get him out of the White House? I think he's going to claim that he's trying to stop people voting now. He's trying to stop the count. He's obviously just going to lose. I don't think he'll ever admit losing. That's the trouble, you know?
Yeah, well, no, indeed, it's obviously a fascinating psychological insight, but you know, maybe that's what you need to be some kind of, you know, billionaire or purported billionaire or whatever he is. Maybe that's what we're missing. But it is striking, you know, certainly in some states he wants the votes to continue, and in other states he wants the votes not to continue, depending on whether he's losing or winning. But there you go, that's politics and politicians for you. What do I think will happen? I think he will go, but we obviously in America there's that weird, strange dead period between the before the inauguration day, you know, which is in late January, you know, two-thirds of the way through January or something. So yeah, it's going to be a strange old time. To me it highlights again that whilst there's been extreme love for American assets and the dollar over the last few years, or the last decade to be honest, the overlooked parts of the world, you know, emerging market stocks have started to outperform now, which I find interesting. And certainly, you know, we've talked before about how you look at China. If we dropped into Beijing or Shanghai today, you would say, crikey, it feels quite normal in the sense that people aren't wearing masks. They are milling about, they're doing stuff and pushing the economy forward. And so, yeah, the world is changing and evolving. But for UK stock, because I think what it means is that it's an active investing world and UK assets are being out of favour. You get the other side of some Brexit compromise and American fund managers looking to diversify into other global assets. Maybe UK economy doesn't look quite as bad as everyone seems to think.
Yeah. So just the Bank of England there, you know, increasing its spending there, buying bonds and obviously forcing the interest rate down, keeping it low. I assume that's not good for banks, is it really? I mean, as I talk about the stocks like Lloyd's and all that, because I see Lloyd's a little bit down a day, because, I mean, obviously they trade on the margin a little bit, what they earn. So I assume it's not, you know, in the short term, that's not bullish for banks, is it?
No, it isn't. Traditionally, no. What you want is a patently a rising yield curve, and we haven't got that because it's skewed and scuppered by QE. If you're doing lots of... The Bank of England now owns 44% of the outstanding UK gilt book, which, you know, is pretty impressive effort, to be honest. And it's that short-term suppresses yields. Now, they won't over the medium term be able to keep that going because in the end, the policy loses credibility. But they've done an all right job over the last decade of slowly building this up. So, yes, that is suppressing gilt yields, no doubt. I think, though, the banks are probably pleased that the apocalyptic option of negative interest rates did not happen today. And that would be potentially, as we've seen in the Eurozone and Japan, that's a real bother for them because that just makes it even harder to get things like, I mean, what do you do, you know, at the margin? If you have negative interest rates, you know, do you, instead of us getting a tiny negligible rate of interest on our savings, do we actually pay money to in order for the right to deposit money in a bank? You know, you have all sorts of weirdisms come out from it. And so at least the Bank of England didn't do that today. They did the old QE teller thing instead. So that's why banks are kind of, thank God for that. At least it wasn't the worst option. But as you say, yeah, they're not catching much of a bid today.
Yeah. And do you know what? It's a good chart, actually. Worth looking at the bank on the BBC site. They've got a sort of bar chart of quantitative easing in the UK, bond purchases by the Bank of England. And they've got the dates, significant dates. 2009, $200 billion they spent there, financial crisis. Yeah. And then 2012, they did €375 billion, Eurozone crisis. 2016, I didn't know it was this big, €445 billion. 2020, dwarfs everything. €895 billion coronavirus pandemic, and actually double the previous bar, which is bigger than all the other bars. So it's worth looking at that, just put it in perspective. Okay, let's look at some individual companies. Who's reporting news today, Chris?
Yeah, loads out. I've got to start with Sainsbury's because Sainsbury's are, actually, I've switched to online food shopping recently.
Yeah.
And it's, I'm a late convert. Everyone listening to this is probably wondering why on earth I hadn't done that a year or 5 years ago or something. But actually, I use Sainsbury's quite a lot on it. It's one of the, I've got a couple of accounts hooked up, and Sainsbury's is one of them. And they actually do a pretty reasonable job, and it's all quite easy to use and everything else. But Sainsbury's today, the numbers are kind of fascinating because in the bullish corner is a special dividend. You know, yes, they still exist, which is nice. Because Sainsbury's wasn't a particularly shabby yielder. You know, you were getting, a 5% plus yield on it, dividend yield on it at prevailing prices. But they've thrown in another 7 change pence dividend. That's 3% equivalent on the dividend yield. So that's quite nice. But they've also talked about statutory losses because, unfortunately, a bunch of people are losing their jobs, primarily at Argos, as, unsurprisingly, you know, you recall they bought Argos a few years back. They are shutting a bunch of Argos stores. Apparently, 90% of Argos sales are now online. You know, no surprises there. They're shutting a whole load of Argos stores and obviously putting counters in Sainsbury's supermarkets, or you just do online delivery or something like that, as you prefer. So it's an interesting combination of metrics. You've then, of course, got the pandemic. And again, as we've seen already with Tesco's and others, they are it's a very funny chart, a couple of charts in their presentation document, where there are huge pains to show that despite making an extra fortune from obviously people like me panic shopping and online delivery and people rushing into their stores because of the pandemic and putting stuff in their food cupboards, that of course it costs them net money despite the fact they got that big benefit, and of course the rates release as well. Despite all of those benefits, it still costs them money because of course they had extra COVID compliance costs and they hired lots of delivery drivers and stuff like that. So it's an interesting combination of comments. Effectively, they're trying to say, we did really well, but not too well. And of course, we're getting rid of a load of people. Oh, but we're paying a special dividend as well. And I think the markets are kind of, what a combination of comments. And the shares are down 2-3% when I last looked today.
Yeah, well, you mentioned being one of those people letting go. And they think, okay, I'm a worker, and I assume a lot of those people working in Argos are not raking it in. You know, it's just close to minimum wage, pretty much. And yet they're being let go, and yet they're paying a special dividend to the investors who've got more than, to be an investor, you've got a bit of cash put aside. So it is a bit. It's the capitalist world, isn't it? It's the capitalist world that everyone hates to see, that ugly face of it, where you're just making people, before Christmas, put them out of a job, but yet rewarding shareholders, which is a bit annoying, I think.
I think if I was Sainsbury's, I would have probably, because this special dividend relates to sort of the last year, and I would have probably just quelled that and kind of maybe in 6 months when you're the other side of the pandemic, these issues aren't quite as raw, as you say. Argos, and, all business people have to run a business properly. And when they bought Argos, everyone said it at the time. Look, we can see the strategy, close a load of Argos stores and stick take them in Sainsbury's. What's kicked on further has been the fact that the pandemic has accelerated e-commerce delivery. And as I said, the only stat you need to know is that 90% of Argos stuff is now purchased online. Yeah. I mean, we all used to, I mean, I'm sure you, when you were younger, I did. You go to the Argos store and you write some kind of something on a slip of paper and somebody disappears into some customer's back office to bring it out for you. I mean, that just seems anachronistic in today's world. But sadly, that's where lots of people in Argos, of course, were employed.
Yeah, it's odd. Do you know what? I know it's really odd. I find this concept still very odd because I even when going into the stores now, they're search things. I thought, well, why don't they just have? Because they had those little things, little terminals. You had to put the six-figure digit in to see if it's available in the store. And I thought, well, why? And you couldn't search. I thought, this is, and then there's old catalogues. Why don't they just have touch screens where you can just search, you know, just like a Google search there? In fact, you could just have pretty Google, but with a bit of, you know, sort of front-facing software for them. Just for the thing. And they've slowly been going towards an internet shop, pretty much. And I thought, well, what's the point of having an internet shop? You just have the internet. You know, you don't need a shop that has a physical presence in the high street, but it's an internet shop. So, yeah, it's very odd, isn't it? But there we are. The chart is so ugly, isn't it? The chart is awful.
Well, it's interesting. The thing with the Sainsbury's chart is this. If you're absolutely right, but I actually stuck it out 5 years, the last 5 years, and I thought to myself, that's quite interesting, because if you look over the last 5 years, then it starts very shabby, and if you're a long-term Sainsbury's shareholder, you know, head in hands time. And then over the last few months, it's kind of, I'm thinking it's kind of forming a base. And
yeah, we're back I suppose it is, yeah. Pencil. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I'm just thinking, go on.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I agree. Short term, 1 year chart, even probably 2 years chart, it doesn't look hot at all. It looks very problematic. I thought that was quite interesting, though, that sort of 200p we're back down to, you know, horrible headlines today and tomorrow. You know, you can bet that the Daily Mail or probably the Daily Mirror and people like that, the Guardian, are going to be like sticking the knife in on Sainsbury's tomorrow morning in the press. Yeah. But I think shares are actually forging potentially an interesting sort of level here. And as I say, if you're a dividend investor and you're getting 7p special, you've already got a running yield of about 5 to 6%. That's not too shabby. And obviously necessity businesses, good online model, as I've road tested. You know, yes, they struggled in the world where they weren't allowed to push ahead with their Asda deal. But actually, I think they're finding slowly their feet. And there's some other good stuff in the presentation about how they're taking market share and stuff like that. So, yeah, not too bad. A defensive business, not very exciting. 200 pence a share. Yeah, from a total return on investor perspective, not too bad.
Yeah. But so if you go back, like, say, 2014, it peaked at like 420 a share. And then it came down drastically between 2014 2015 to £2, £2.25. Then it's been going in a range then from 220 to 280 for like a couple of years. 2018 then, I don't know what happened to April, was it a merger or something? Or it just gapped up massively from 270, yeah, basically yeah, rose to like, yeah, 330. And then from 330, just come all the way back down. And it's now sort of bumping along the bottom, like I said, at that £2 level. So, yeah. But it's like it's some quite volatile movement there for a big stock, you know.
And defensive area as well. I mean, food retailing is about as boring as it gets. But yeah. The thing is, obviously, that even that area has been changing. Delivery, new competitors. And as I said, the failed Asda Sainsbury's merger, or regulator stopped it, basically. Been lots going on, but yeah, my feeling is, despite everything, despite the slightly crass dividend juxtaposed with job losses thing, I would say quite interesting for like a core portfolio stock. You could make that work, I think.
Yeah, cool. All right, what's next, Chris?
Well, the AstraZeneca, which I think is still the biggest FTSE 100 company by market cap. And obviously, if you're in a long-term shareholder here, then you're absolutely happy as anything, because you punch up the five-year chart of that one, and it's gone from sort of 40-odd quid when they were telling Pfizer where to go in terms of taking it over to 80-odd quid today, and you're happy as anything. So Zeneca, obviously, it's a pharmaceutical company, healthcare company. They reiterated their numbers, so they expect revenues and earnings to grow either side of 10%. which is pretty good, albeit they've had a few lean years over the last few as well. But they seem to be doing all the right things in terms of pipeline and other stuff, lots of sensible comments there. And of course, they've got this COVID treatment. They're doing obviously something in association with the University of Oxford, which everyone is potentially excited about. Obviously not going to be maybe a huge money spender for them, but in terms of goodwill and love and everything else, it's obviously a win-win. So that's all fine. But my observation on AstraZeneca, I don't own the shares, is that just the absolute love and faith for this one is so high at the moment. You know, it's not the cheapest share in the world. If you look statically, it's trading on a PE of 20 times something. And sure, if you extrapolate and think what their new products could bring and the goodwill from the COVID treatment, sure, you can get it down to a sort of a higher teens multiple in a year or two, which I guess is for a healthcare leader is maybe a bit more workable. But yeah, it's kind of, it's almost like the Sainsbury's chart on its head, if you know what I mean, in the sense that it's run and run. But if you look more recently, that sort of circa £80 level, that's a bit of a resistance point. I think they're struggling to really crack on from that. And you know, when I last looked today, good numbers, reiterated everything, COVID love, etc. The shares, I think, were slightly down when I last looked on the day. So you know, not a lot of follow through on what were actually quite sensible numbers.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? I mean, there's been quite a few companies say, well, AstraZeneca are not going to make money on this and it's good for them. But when you think of it, it's going to be like the flu. So they pile a lot of money into it, but they've been given a lot of money to help with it. But it's going to be around every year. A new vaccine like the flu will be around every year. So AstraZeneca, obviously a new strain. So I assume they'll be making money over it over the long term, because it's one of those, you know, mass vaccines that will happen every year like the flu. And they're one of the big producers. So surely they'll be making money over the longer term, won't they?
Oh, I think they'll make, put it this way, they won't lose money, but yeah. Think about the positive PR.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Think
yeah.
about all, and the thing is, we're strange beasts as consumers, and obviously, ultimately, AstraZeneca is trying to sell its products to a range of doctors and healthcare facilities, and of course, individuals, you know, and if you see that little AstraZeneca motif on the corner of your packet tablets of whatever it might be, or cardiovascular treatment or whatever, just gives you that sort of warm feeling. And so that is a funny kind of intangible thing, but when you sort of push that around the world, the positive PR, the marketing, the markets that opens up, the deals that can be done, all the goodwill it generates, I mean, you can't put a price on that. So it, you know, it's great they're doing everything they're doing, and I hope they're successful. As you know, similarly, I hope all the other people doing some very ingenious stuff in the COVID research area, I hope they're wholly successful and we get the other side of this horrid and terrible pandemic. But you're right. The reality is we're not going to get a knockout pill or treatment, certainly not in the short term. It's all going to be mitigation, a bit like we mitigate flus and cold. We suppress them and we make life like if you have a sneezing fit, You take something for it and you get the other side of it, and you can do podcasts without it being interrupted by 1,000 sneezes. Now I've said that, probably you're going to be one. But, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So Seneca is quite clever in that sense. My observation as a purely kind of straight investment, I'm not excited because it is so loved. Multiple is full. Yeah. Progress is good.
Yeah. What it's got going for it is momentum and trend, and that's pretty much it at the moment. Like I say, how far can that keep going, though? Like I say, 111 million, you know, what's the thing here? Yeah, 111 billion. That's right, yeah. So, yeah. Wow, that's a big company.
That's a small company. I'm pretty sure it's the biggest company on the FTSE now. I mean, it's obviously Vodafone used to be it, but they bogged up their strategy in various ways. Well, I guess we've all got mobile phones. It's become more of a commoditized industry. Obviously, the banks, HSBC, Royal Dutch, etc., in the energy space, they've had their issues. I'm pretty sure Zeneca is now the top dog. Yeah. But yeah, no small company by any means. So well, every pension fund in the world, but it's stuffed to the gills.
Yeah, I think Royal Dutch Shell, I'm looking at now, 76 billion HSBC is now below that. So, because they've all been hammered, HSBC and, you know, 66 billion HSBC, because HSBC and Royal Dutch Shell both been hammered, whereas AstraZeneca keep climbing. So that's the difference there, I suppose. One's gone one way. Anyway, cool. Anything else, Chris?
put one on Auto Trader. Yeah. So Auto Trader is a fascinating stock, actually, Auto Trader, because I must admit, it's not one I would have thought I would have found wholly interesting, but network effect, I think, is good there. And as we've seen with stocks like Rightmove, you can't bet against that. That's a nice sort of a concept, underlying investment concept. Mm. So Auto Trader came out with some thoughts about the first half, but and obviously also about prospective trading as well. First half has the usual combination. They made a tad of money in the first quarter, but obviously that's the peak lockdown period. And they made better profits, unsurprisingly, in the second quarter. What I found really interesting with the observations about sort of today and prospective trading, they said in October they had a record number of cars on their site, and also they had a record number of views, you know, people looking through and potentially doing stuff. So I actually thought some of the trends there were not bad. The thing with Auto Trader stock is I can't believe it's back to the level it was at pre-pandemic. We're back at that sort of circa, I think it's 600p level, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you know, I have to say, I put it down as a sort of a wait for the fall kind of have a look then sort of name, but we haven't had that yet. It has been bulletproof. This share has exhibited some volatility this year, but it's done pretty damn well in the wider scheme of things. And I like the tone of today's announcement. You kind of feel they're the clear market leader and they are forging some kind of a very clear network effect.
Yeah, and there didn't seem any. I mean, that's one of the things about having been the top dog in an industry, like the market leader. They don't seem to have many, you know, challenges either. It's because now they're at a certain size, they're dominating, and they can afford, you know, to get the best sort of tech people in and offer the best deals. So, I mean, what's different is in Rightmove is a similar sort of, you know, portal there that doesn't hold stock, of course. Just and of course that's a market leader as well, by far bigger than any other competitor. But there are competitors there, and they are growing a little bit. Whereas Auto Trader is out there on its own, pretty much. You know, it seems like so.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, surely a big. I think what could happen. Amongst, you know, I suppose it's happening at the moment probably, but like with, real estate, like on the market, for example, have got together and they've got all the estate agents together now and they are getting some traction. I've been watching them for a while. I do hold some stock now on the market because of that. And their rent's going up, their agents have got very close to Rightmove, but the valuation is ridiculous. So on the market, Rightmove is 90 times the valuation of on the market. And if you look at the growth on the market's getting, it's Rightmove must be looking at it. With Auto Trader, they need to get a lot of, you know, car sales together and form their own portal and start. But it takes a lot of money,
yes,
a lot of time, and there's no chance of success. So it's a risky thing. But, you know, my father owns a car sales and he says, they're so expensive, Auto Trader. But that's the same with Rightmove. But you've got to, you know, it's a necessary evil. You've got to have your stock on there because everyone looks at it, you know? So there we are.
Right. Yeah, no. It's whether you choose, as I say, to go through alternative distribution.
Yeah.
And of course, all these auto companies, they've been talking about how they've got their online capabilities have gone through the roof, which you would expect given the backdrop what we've seen in the last 8 or 9 months. So that's all good. But Auto Trader, I guess, gives you that nationwide coverage, yeah, you know, at a finger stroke,
yeah,
and a lot of eyeballs. And yeah, so I was quite impressed. Don't own the stock. The share price graph, as I say, it looks as if we're back at that kind of resistance level. But yeah, an unusual shape given everything we know. And, you know, well done them or any investors who spotted that actually this one could be a lot more defensive than perhaps you would have instinctively thought.
Yeah, well, I jumped in during the dip. I didn't quite get the bottom of the dip, but I did jump in and make a bit of I was a dirty trader on an Auto Trader. And I got a nice little bit of a profit. Didn't put a lot in, but... But I thought it bounced back up almost 550, or I think it sold. I thought it can't go much further because that was, you know, literally in during the lockdown, it was nearly back towards its highs. That's nuts. It's got to fall back, but it hasn't fallen back that much, you know. So there we are.
No, that's right.
Marvelous stuff, Chris. Thanks for that, and we'll speak to you next week.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, money analyst and partner at SP Angel. You're right, John.
Yes, good. Thank you.
You keep your tabs on the US elections?
I stayed up and watched a load of it.
Yeah, yeah. What do you know?
Whilst playing beer pong.
Okay, I'm just seeing a tweet from Associated Press saying now Biden I don't. It's not anywhere else. They've still got on the college votes. They obviously 270 to win. They've got Biden 243, Trump 214. But I just saw one from Associated Press saying 264 now for Biden. If that's true, we've got six more college votes left to get, and Trump now has to win every state apart from one. Five left, I think, to announce he has to win every apart from one. And like we were just chatting beforehand, and said, you know, if he just played on his economic strengths, what he's done, I think he's done well. But like I said, the infighting, the tweets, the childish, you know, sort of name calling has not done him any favours at all, has it really?
Yeah, if Trump's lost this election, it's all his own fault. Because if you look at how close the votes are in many states and many areas, it was Trump's election to lose, and looks like he's probably lost it. So
yeah. All you need to do is keep it simple. You know, you said he's championed the stock market. If you just stay with that, with creating jobs, you know, like you said, you're going to do creating jobs, you know, the stock market rises. If you just stuck with that, he probably could have won hands down here. Okay, he's messed up coronavirus. A lot of people have. A lot of governments have, because it's a left-field thing. You don't know how to react to it. So, but if he'd just gone with that rather than, you know, really riled the media, name-calling, tweeting things I wouldn't even tweet, you know? And so it's ridiculous. I mean, like I said, to not get a second term, it's basically you've really messed up. You know, people give him a chance, and they've ended up not liking what he stood for, and he sort of divided America rather than pulled them together, and he didn't need to be that way. But there we go. I don't think he'll admit he's lost, and I think he'll go to his grave saying he didn't lose that election, you know? It's like some of these boxing matches you see. I remember, I think it was Marvin Hagler against Sugar Ray Leonard, big fight they had, and to this day, Marvin Hagler, who lost, says, I didn't lose that fight. And so I think that'll go to... I can't admit see Trump admitting he's lost, you know?
No, he doesn't like to admit anything like that. But running an economy is not the same as running a reality game show. So, you know, it's a much more serious thing. And of course, the people vote for what's best for them. Yeah. And so they should. And it looks like they're not, you know, the balance of power has swung towards the Democrats. Although, let's face it, Democrats are more like our right-wing Tories, as far as I can see.
Yeah, cool. Marvellous stuff. Okay, let's get on to some macro, maybe some micro news. What's happening out there? What's the theme? Any news out there, John?
Yeah, some interesting macro news. I mean, China, 30% rise in construction machinery sales so far this year. That almost entirely offsets the slowdown that we've seen in the rest of the world. I mean, some other countries have also done really well. Turkey's got sales up 112%. Brazil's up 43%. But then we've got Europe, which is slow as always, where sales have fallen. The UK and Ireland, sales have also fallen there, sadly, despite announcements or pronouncements of substantial stimulus. The projects are just not happening right now. So, you know, partly due to planning, partly due to the fact that developers and are more cautious. So, and of course, we're just in another lockdown, which isn't going to help that either. So everybody wants to ramp up economic growth, but the Chinese are proving that they're the best guys at doing it.
Yeah. Part of me, I'm not a fan of conspiracy theories, but part of me thinks, you know, if China wanted to invent some kind of virus that would, you know, help them and weaken the rest of the world, the coronavirus is pretty much the perfect virus for that, you know? It's well, done. They've recovered pretty much, haven't they? You know?
A virus seems to come out of China roughly every 10 years. In fact, slightly more often than that. And China's got used to dealing with these things domestically, and we haven't, because these things have been held back within China in the last couple of epidemics that they've had. But this one, of course, was harder to control, much more difficult to contain, and of course has spread very, very quickly around the rest of the world. So I'm not sure we can categorically blame China for it, but the fact is a lot of these things have been coming out of China for years. There's obviously an area where these sorts of infections and viruses jump from animals to humans, maybe in the wet fish markets or maybe elsewhere. And one of the reasons why China is urbanizing and why China was urge to urbanize by the World Health Organization 20, 30 years ago was because of these epidemics that were coming round. So people have seen these health issues and the danger of them coming at us for a long time. And part of China's urbanization strategy is to reduce the number of people living in poverty, living in under a subsistence culture within China. And it's working harder to get millions more people out of those poverty-stricken villages and into a more Western lifestyle in cities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, what company news, anything out there? You mentioned platinum group metals and all that stuff, and...
Platinum and palladium prices certainly looking set to jump higher. Amplats, that's Anglo American Platinum, has closed its converting furnace plant in South Africa, and that's a huge problem. So they've immediately lowered their sales guidance for this year to 2.5 million ounces from about 3.2 million ounces. So there's a lot of platinum that the market's going to be short of platinum probably for the next 3 to 6 months, maybe even 6 to 12 months. And so we've been writing about that this morning, and there aren't many companies that you can buy. I mean, you can buy Sibanye-Stillwater or Impala Platinum in South Africa. And these companies have US GDRs, or you could buy Eurasia Mining in the UK, which has palladium-rich projects in Russia, in the Urals, but there aren't a lot of places you can go to for these sorts of metals, and that's one of the problems.
That was Eurasia. Any stock that rises very quickly, you know, they came on the podcast a couple of times, and they went from, I think they were about sort of 4 to 8 pence when they came on the podcast, I think, and now they're like close to 30 pence. So it's done well, hasn't it? It's really rocketed up.
Well, we took on the brokership of this company a few months ago, and we worked very hard to get the company requoted because it had been suspended for various reasons. Mm. And I think there were a number of short positions by market makers. I'm not quite sure how or why, but anyway, as soon as the stock requoted, it jumped significantly higher, and it's held up there. So it's very interesting. I think their plan is to sell the business to probably a Russian buyer because the palladium price is so high, because it's so hard to get palladium, and because there's so much of it's concentrated in South Africa that's a massive risk to production. So there is definitely a case for somebody coming in and wanting to buy this business. Mm. Whether they want to pay the price on the screen is another matter.
Yeah. You mentioned something going on with Rainbow Rare Earths. What's happening there?
Well, Rainbow have just acquired a tailings project. It's very rich in rare earth metals, and it's particularly unusual. It's got the world's highest concentration of neodymium and praseodymium within the rare earth grade. Grade's 0.6%, but it's because it's in tailings, it's very easy to mine. I mean, it'll have almost zero mining cost, and very easy to extract, we think. So what happened was Sasol, which is a South African, a very large South African chemicals business, developed a pilot plant for the extraction of these rare earth materials, and had it up and running. They produced 3 tons of rare earth concentrate, which they sold to Japan, but unfortunately they were forced to divest the asset by the South African competition authorities because Sasol were dominating too much of the phosphate market. So this is really a phosphate mine and production process, and the rare earth bit was bolted on the side. But because of the price of the neodymium and praseodymium, the value of that in these rare earths, or shall we say the extractable value of that, is running about $1.3 billion. So Rainbow have got themselves into something really very interesting here, and actually management are very excited about it, because if the cost of extraction is not very much, then that's an awful lot of value to take out of those tailings for probably not much cost.
Okay. Any other news there?
Well, yeah, because it has been an interesting week for news. SolGold, who have their huge Alpala copper porphyry in Ecuador, Also have a lot of exploration ground, and they've been drilling another copper porphyry called Paul Vernier. And their first hole, I mean, they must have the luck of the Irish, which is a bit odd for some Australian geologists, but they hit an enormous amount of copper, starting very close to surface. And we like the fact that this is starting close to surface because it means it should be much cheaper to start the extraction. So for me, this is a particularly exciting hole. There's a section of 188 meters of it, which average 0.56% copper and 0.23 grams a ton of gold. And those end up quite nice grades considering the size of the section. There was another 106 meters within that hole that was slightly higher again. So we can't say it's going to be a mine off just one hole, but I'm really looking forward to the next drilling results, which should come through quite soon, because this looks really very exciting.
Yeah. And what's the chart like on silver gold? And what is the valuation of silver gold these days?
The market cap is around £650 million. it trades very well as a company. We've always called it the Vodafone of the small cap mining market. Yeah. And it's backed by BHP and Newcrest, who are partners on the Alpala project. But for me, I think the real value is going to come from new discoveries in the portfolio, because they were very early movers at staking ground in Ecuador, which most mining companies have pulled out of over the years due to its government, which was quite closely aligned to the Venezuelans for quite a while. And now the mining companies have gone back in, and things are and the government's much more friendly. SolGold have got a commanding position.
Yeah, okay, marvellous stuff. SOLG, John, thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak to you next week.
Look forward to it, thank you.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Wishbone Gold. At four, Sunrise Resources. Wishbone is up 20%, pretty much, 2 pence. Sunrise up 11% to 0.31. At three, Remote Monitor Systems. It's risen very quickly of late, but that's down 5%, 2.8 pence there. At two as well, also related to the company, management-wise, is IQAI, up 62%. Big rise yesterday to 20.75 pence. And at one, Attis Oil and Gas. Wow, up 117%. You get that in these small caps, micro caps. They can do that in a day. Most of them will pop and drop, if they're not sustainable, of course. But it's a trader's dream, a dirty trader's dream. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Amrit reports. In fact, there's one missed out here worth looking at, actually. I look at Arix Bioscience. Hopefully going to get the guys on the podcast, but one of their investee companies been bought by Merck for $2.5 billion. And that equates to about $120 million market cap on its own, and they have lots of other investments. So check that out. Amrit reports record Q3 results, raising full year 2020 revenue guidance. At four, Biffa half year results. At three, Blencoe Resources, publication of new research note. At two, IQAI, Montgomery Cancer Center purchases IB software. And at one, Open Orphan, new 2.5 million influenza challenge study contract. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.